All right, we're going to head over to the Zoom line here where we got our special video going here. Earlier today, I was in a sports attire. Now today, we're going to be talking about something completely different. And this brings me back to the night show I used to do. I used to do a 3-hour night show, and we'd get in some deep dive topics. And one of the topics I've been following on social media is on the Micah Francis investigation down in, is it North Carolina or South Carolina? Because it did cross state lines. I do get confused. Myrtle Beach is where it's located. And we were bringing in Stacey Schaefer with the 31-8 Project to talk about domestic violence, or DV, as we have to say on social media, and also ST, or sex trafficking. And for me, I've been following it for almost 10 years through the energy communities. When there is a energy community, generally there's a spike in sex trafficking, domestic violence, and other social issues to that magnitude. Stacey Schaefer recently did a conference out in the Bakken oil fields just on those topics specifically. We're being joined by Black Sheep and also Sorted Out, two social media sleuths who've been following the Micah Francis case. And thank you two for joining us. Black Sheep, how are you? Start with you. Hello.
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you for joining us. Sorted Out, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you for having us.
If you wouldn't mind, take a couple minutes and just kind of give yourselves an overview how you're linked to the just kind of the Micah Francis investigation, whether it's through proximity, geography, whether it's through, for me, it's the social issue that drew me in. And Sorted Out, we'll start with you. How are you linked to this case?
So I grew up in a household with narcissistic parents and parents that inflicted domestic violence upon each other. So while I've never had domestic violence inflicted upon me, I've experienced in other ways. So anytime that I come across something that involves domestic violence or what I believe to have narcissistic tendencies and abuse, I indulge myself in it. I like to, just get involved, find out why, find out the reasons, and bring justice. Obviously, we can't bring justice. The FBI, the police departments are the ones that ultimately have to do that, but try to give these victims a voice. Their voice has been taken from them, and just try to be the voice for them that they no longer, unfortunately, are able to have.
Black Sheep, how about you? What was your attraction and your link to this case?
So the reason why I got involved in this case and what stuck out to me was actually JP himself. My husband and I actually dealt with a child. So we dealt with child on parent domestic violence. We dealt with a child that was very abusive to not only my husband, but to me. And seeing JP really resonated with me because, like I said, this is how our son was. And I think a lot of people don't understand that, domestic violence doesn't just start when you turn 18. There are or can be signs way before that. And I like to bring awareness to this because there are a lot of parents out there that experience this and there is not help out there. And depending on where you live, it's difficult, and it's a difficult subject, and it's a difficult thing for parents to handle. So that's how I got involved in this case. And I, like to bring awareness to the child on parent abuse because it does happen and it is a form of domestic violence.
I appreciate the two of you joining us. And Stacey Schaefer is with the 31-8 Project. And I asked her to join this panel tonight because really what I'd like to do is, from my point of view, as a journalist and as a reporter and that sort of thing, this is one of the more remarkable. I tell people, this is like O.J. Simpson and Casey Anthony times 10. If I was a executive for the Lifetime Network, I could do a new feature every day, a new angle on this case for a year and not repeat myself. There's so much to this. And so it's so hard where to start. And Stacey, for me, the part that stood out to me when I was down in Midland, Texas, or I was in Oklahoma City or Watford City, was how the sex trafficking was beginning at such a young age. And the part of this Micah Francis, J.P. Miller case that stood out to me as a baptized Catholic and ordained minister is how J.P. was allegedly grooming her at the age of 14. Now, when we're talking about sex trafficking, it's starting as early as six, as early as eight, and et cetera. But whether it's online, whether it's in the church, talk to me a little bit, Stacy, about what's going on with the grooming and trafficking, because that is such an important element for parents to understand and for anyone from me to sort it out to black sheep to be aware of the red flags and the signs.
For sure. I think that's what's interesting. You know, after talking to you and diving a little bit deeper into this case, when you think about grooming and you think about things like human trafficking, often people think it's the guy that drives a white van and wears a hoodie. And that's honestly not what we see at all. In fact, the most common type of trafficking we're seeing, specifically in North Dakota and talking to partners in other parts of the country, is familial trafficking, where that family member is that trafficker. And or it's the aunt, the uncle, a relative, someone you trust, right? And I think we often think that people in certain positions that they are untouchable and that they would never, you know, commit a crime. But sometimes those are the people, because of their status, they're sometimes able to get away with that because people are afraid to come forward. And so the grooming process can start, you know, it can take years to groom somebody. It could take a couple of months. It really just depends on the situation and what's going on. And those grooming tactics range from, you know, love, affection, attention, gifts, you know, taking people on trips, things like that is what we can see in these scenarios. So I definitely think, you know, we see these things more often, but you're so blinded to it often when you're in the situation, like you don't even realize it's happening until much later. I mean, some of the survivors we work with, it's been, you know, 5-6 years when they're out of the life that they realize what actually happened to them. So it's very rare for victims in trafficking cases, while they are being victimized, to realize that they're actually being trafficked. A lot of times they think it's their own fault. Like, I chose this, this is what I chose, when in reality, that person who groomed them fed them that story. And then add on to this trauma bonding, Stockholm syndrome, all of those factors, it adds just another layer to the complexities of these situations.
Sorted out, when you've been following the Micah Francis case, what's your interpretation, perspective, or view of the grooming bin from the case's point of view?
From what I understand, it started as early as 13, 14 years old, and lasted until she was unlocked. As far as the gifting, whenever she was 16 years old, she was babysitting for him and his previous wife. And he was buying her cars and clothes and jewelry. And, you know, that's how he reeled her in. He even made the statement, he married, I don't know how much you're familiar with the case, but he married her and her previous husband, who was his best friend. And he even stated that he first fell in love with her when she was walking down the aisle, marrying her first husband when they were marrying him. So, you know, the grooming started at a very young age. He was gifting her. He was love bombing her. Even whenever she was a teenager babysitting from her, he would do things to separate he and his wife to where he could spend time with her. He would do things to separate her husband and herself to where he could spend time with her. So it's.
He was her boss at the church, right? Right. That's right. Yeah. So he would actually send the husband to go do this, and then he would go and spend time with her on this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Oh, I forgot about that. Yes.
And you bring up a good point. You know, something I didn't even touch on is the isolation. And that's a very, very common tactic in these scenarios too, is isolating the person from their family and friends. And again, the little bit that I know, I mean, what you're just saying is definitely those telltale signs of grooming taking place. So yeah, very, very interesting. I want
So,
to add.
he started out as her youth pastor, and from what we've gathered from this case, and it has not been proven, but just from what we've heard from this case, it sounds like home life may have not been the most perfect environment for her. Mom has been married 7 times, so it sounds like she had many stepdads through the years, and it seems like when they joined that church, JP took full advantage of the situation that she was in, because there were also reports from her father and the family that he would, because of what was going on at home, he would actually find her places to stay with other people that were members of the church.
So he would intervene and really control his in that way as well. Stacy, what are some what should someone do? Like, I mean, we're not talking about the white van here. We're talking about the pastor at the church. I mean, the only I don't know if there's a bigger trust. I mean, there's a teacher, yeah, there's a principal, there's a cop, the policeman. Pastor, I think, is the top, right? I mean, you can't have a bigger public but it's a spiritual
Well,
trust even.
yes. And please correct me if I'm wrong with this case, because just from what I was looking into, it sounds like JP definitely controlled the church. Even the elders, the people on the board, they had no power or authority. So at the end of the day, like that structure is not common either. Whether I mean, I work for a nonprofit, right? Churches are nonprofits as well. We have a structure that we have to follow, things like that. So right off the bat, he was able to control and manipulate his congregation and the people on his team. So that makes it even more difficult, because if he's able to do that with the elders within the church, other people within the congregation, if you are a victim in this, you're going to feel really, really scared to come forward. And from what I'm reading, it sounds like there are potentially other victims that he groomed throughout the years that are too scared to come forward. And please correct me if I'm wrong. This is just what, like doing a quick dive into this, what I was seeing. So as I was reading into this, it does not surprise me. It is difficult to report a crime like this against someone. And then also, it sounds like people who have tried to go forward, they've hit dead ends. So I would tell people to go forward, right, and keep pushing, but I understand why people are scared to do so. So what I would say for community members in this, and for general public, if you suspect something is going on in someone's life, you really need to be an advocate for that person and help them, befriend them, show them that they can trust you so that they can confide in you and help them to get the services that they need. Maybe it's not the fact that they want to pursue justice with law enforcement. Maybe it's just removing them out of that situation and getting them to a safe place. But you, as that person, and you know, I work with a lot of different houses of worship, and something I always say is, part of that congregation, when somebody comes in, if they don't look like you or they're different, that doesn't matter. Like, your job is to accept them, take them in, talk to them. And I'm seeing in this situation, I don't know if people were afraid to do that, they didn't think about doing that, or what the deal is, but I would just really encourage people, you see something that's off, befriend that person, keep checking in on them until they trust you, because once they trust you, they will open up, but they just got to build that trust first.
So from what we have observed and what we've been told by like her family, a lot it's not just even church members that are afraid. It is like the whole community that is afraid of this man. There were people in the community that gave donations to the family, you know, for different expenses and that. And they asked the family, they said, please, please, we want to do this anonymously. Do not let anybody know that it was us that gave it to you. We own businesses here, and if he finds out, our business will be shut down. We will be done.
And that brings up a very good question. And I don't know if there's even a right answer to this, because this is probably the million dollar question when it comes to these types of issues. And this is, by the way, this is open to anybody. One of the main themes when it comes to whether it's a narcissist or domestic violence or something along those lines, a lot of times the support group is infiltrated or infected before the person even has an opportunity to react. So now when they go and reach out to a couple people, they're not getting the support they thought they'd get. And now it's almost like they're scorned. They touched that hot stove. So they're afraid to reach out to their friends and family because they don't want to sit and argue that they're not, you know, mentally insane or they're not the crazy one or whatever. And again, I don't know who can even answer this question, because once that well is poisoned, that's, you know, the wagons have been circled. Man, that's a tough place to, you have no footing.
It is. Stacey. It is. Yeah. And that's why they often say is, you know, especially for survivors of sex trafficking, it often takes 10 to 12 times before they're really able to leave their trafficker. And even once they leave, we're talking 13 different services that we're looking at to really help them reintegrate back into the community in a safe way. I have a survivor we worked with who she confided to her friend what her situation was, and her friend said she deserved what was happening to her. So exactly to your point, like those are things that we see all the time. And all we can really do is stress to people, like, that's not how you approach this. You know, when we're doing education, what are our job? What is our responsibility as the community to try to intervene? And I get it, though. I get people are scared. There's a lot of pressure against people. But all it takes is that one person too, right? And so if like you can be the one to break in there and start that conversation, you don't know what the trickle effect's going to be. So I still want to encourage people to do that, even though I understand it, like in this scenario, that's scary. There is a lot of scare tactics being used. But, you know, I want to encourage people to not give up on individuals either, like to keep trying too.
So in this case, it is alleged that his father sexually abused him when he was a child. So could you speak to that with your expertise and your knowledge as to why and what that could do to him and why he would do the things he does now? Not that you know.
Right. It's an interesting topic to bring up because I also am in charge of, it's called the demand reduction program, and it's a sentencing diversion program for buyers. So people who solicit people for sex acts, if they get caught, they get sentenced to that course. And, you know, when we started it, we just saw these people as criminals, right? Like these are just terrible people, all that. And just keep in mind, I'm not excusing anybody's behavior here, but what we found out through this course is a lot of people have gone through a lot of different things in their life, and to see the trickle effect it has had, we were not shocked. You know, like we saw anything from a husband and wife lost their child to cancer when he was 3. All of a sudden, the husband made one bad decision after another. Again, I'm not excusing this. We see a lot of situations with pornography, right? Like I started watching this. All of a sudden, I was watching it every day too. It controlled me, and now it's controlling my relationship. Again, bad decision after bad decision. So when you think of like criminal activity in general too, just from that, and you just look at profiles of different criminals, it's not uncommon that they haven't had the best home life themselves. So again, I'm not excusing that. But when I did read more into this and saw that he experienced sexual abuse, that triggered in me, it's a repeated behavior that's right. Happening. And he never got the right resources for himself. And so now he's just repeating it. It's kind of like people being born into trafficking situations, right? Where you're one of your family members is a pimp. You're born into that. And so the cycle just continues. And I think that's what we're seeing here too, that there was just, I'm sure it was swept under the rug. Nobody ever talked about it. It's taboo to talk about those things. And so he never really dealt with it. Well, that's going to come out somewhere. Like that energy has to come out somewhere. And I think that's what we're seeing in this scenario.
That makes
sense. Again, not excusing it, you know, but I definitely, I see a lot in the work we do where the traffickers and the buyers, there's often another story there that we have to look at.
I have a question for you, and this has come up a couple of times in discussions that we had, and a lot of people are talking about the dark triad. I mean, from what we've seen, a lot of people feel like, you know, JP has the dark triad. I mean, can you speak on that? Do you know anything about that?
I know a little bit, but I feel like I don't know enough to really speak to it in depth. So, I've heard of that, but, I just don't feel confident knowing enough to speak on it.
Okay.
Which isn't helpful, but.
No, that's fine. Like when we have somebody like him and I mean, his age, is there a way to help him, or are we kind of like, okay, because of his age, there is no like, and I use this word loosely, like fixing him. Do you know what I'm saying?
Rehabilitation.
Yeah. Right. When it comes to cases and we, you know, I teach in the criminal justice world as well. And something we talk about even in juvenile justice is when it's sexually related crimes, it is very tough to provide adequate rehabilitation. And so, and not that, you know, the programs aren't out there, but it is really difficult. Even when you look at sex offender programs as well, they're out there, but studies have shown that it is very difficult to 100% be rehabilitated from that. And so I always say, you know, we have to have hope, right? We have to have hope, but we also know statistically that that's a challenge for rehabilitation when it comes to sexually related crimes. So I don't want to say he can't, right? But I also know statistically it can be very challenging, especially considering his background and then also what he has been doing now as he's gotten older. That's just going to get more and more difficult to treat as we get older if we haven't dealt with it. It's going to take more time, you know, to provide adequate rehabilitation, and the person has to want it and believe that they actually have a problem too.
I've got a question, Stacey. It's a little bit different, I guess, because we're talking about maybe preventative measures now. And one of the ways is to identify the red flags, to identify signs, to identify behaviors. And we're talking about a personality type as a dark triad. We're talking about a narcissist as another personality type. A sociopath personality type might be in there as well. But that is there other types of personalities, or, you know, in business they have the EMTFs and the different EMGs and the all these different personality tests you can take in corporate America. Do they have anything like that in your world, I guess?
No, but what I can say, what is pretty common in these scenarios, when we work with law enforcement, they'll tell you, you know, I can work with drug dealers, I can even work with murderers. What I struggle with is working with traffickers. And the problem is because of that narcissism that we're talking about and the fact that they just don't care about human life, you can't find a common ground. And so usually when you're working with other types of criminals, you can find a common ground when you're doing an interrogation. But when you are working with traffickers, this is what I've heard over and over again from law enforcement, they are the most challenging people to work with because of that narcissism, and to even get anything that you could relate to them on can be such a challenge because, again, they just don't care about human life. They're more fixated on themselves than anything else. So to try to break through that is very challenging. So that we've seen a lot of, that's been very common amongst traffickers for sure. And I would even, you know, go a little bit further. We had one trafficker in a case where when he was taken to prison, he was so manipulative that he was able to convince prison guards to smuggle a phone in for him so that he could work his operation. And they even took it a step further. He was able to convince them to write him good letters of character for the court case. And at that time, we believed that there were about 30 different victims in his case. So just to show you, how creative these people are, that they're able to manipulate anybody if they really want to, and they put that energy. So it just makes you wonder, if they put their energy towards something good, what could possibly happen?
That
Right.
brings up, but that brings up another very good part of this whole Micah Francis, JP Miller investigation. And I'm going to hand it over to Black Sheep or Sort It Out on this, because one of the things that's come out of this is called Micah's Law. And there's an effort now to rewrite or recreate some of the laws involving with domestic violence and trafficking. And the other night at, like, I don't know, 4 in the morning, it was, for me, it was 4 in the morning. I was up working. Black Sheep and I, we got on one of those lives and talked about, you can write all the laws in the world, but if the nobody's going to enforce them, who cares? That type of thing. First of all, Sort It Out, are you familiar with the Micah's Law at all? And some of the reasons for this, because from my understanding, Micah had tried to go to law enforcement multiple times about this. And I've mentioned this to where she cried out for help so much to where she actually went to get self-defense, and she was right all the way up till the end. And no one listened to her. Nobody listened to her. As much as they tried to, really, nobody took her serious. Nobody listened to her. And so, what are some of the things that Micah did to try to get attention, either from Black Sheep or from Sort It Out? Because for me, posting a nude picture of your wife online and nobody can actually get involved with that is a little bit bizarre to me.
So some of the things that she did to try and get help, in the span of less than a month's time, she made 5 different police reports, about various things, but 5 different police reports. She requested a restraining order. She filled the paperwork out. It was brought before a judge, and somewhere along the lines, it was said that the paperwork was filled out wrong. Keep in mind, she also had a lawyer that was representing her at this time. But the judge said that the paperwork was filled out wrong, to go and refill this paperwork out and resubmit it, and then that it could be talked about being submitted then. But it was never resubmitted. She had a lawyer that she had paid a $10,000 retaining fee to. So there's questions. Why didn't her lawyer help her resubmit this paperwork? Why wasn't this restraining order passed? Why wasn't this restraining order put into place? She had. There's multiple other things. Black Sheep, you want to touch on some other things?
Yeah, I mean, when we're talking about police reports, we are talking about him putting her life in danger. He put the, now he didn't just slash her tires. He put these things that you can order offline. They're special razors that you like sit in these tires, so when you drive, the tire explodes. He did this numerous times to her. She had numerous reports, called the police numerous times, and numerous reports were filled out on this. And all the police kept saying to her is, well, we don't have proof it was him. Didn't do any investigating, didn't try to figure out if it was him. The one place that it happened, well, several places
Mr.
that it happened, I'm pretty sure there were cameras around, but they didn't even take the time to go pull like the camera footage to see if it was him that put this on her. There were also numerous reports of, I shouldn't say numerous reports, there was one or two reports, I think, police reports filled out about him putting tracking devices on her car. And that's another thing too, that we really aren't sure of which car she was driving. The cars that she, the whatever car she was driving was not put in the police report, and all they said to her was, well, you're married to him, this is marital property, so he has a right to put this tracking on your car if he chooses to. But right now, Sort It Out and are trying to figure out what car she was driving at the time, because the one car that she did own that was hers, he took away from her. So if she was driving, she was living with her godmother. If she was driving her godmother's car, it would be illegal for him to put that tracking device on her car. She also told the police officers that she was afraid for her life. She told her family, her lawyers, numerous people, that if I end up with a bullet in my head, it was not me. It was John Paul. And nobody listened to her. And I don't want to say people didn't take her seriously. I don't know if it's just that from what we heard, he had such a power over everybody in that community, including judges and police officers. Is that the reason why they didn't do anything? Or were they just not doing their job? Or did they just kind of like blow this off? You know, I mean, he did have a lot of people convinced that she was mentally ill, and you know, the stuff that she was saying was delusional. And you know, he would say things like she didn't, you know, there were days she didn't even know who he was. And it's just, it's crazy the scenario that he painted of her.
So, Stacey, getting back to, the Micah's Law, and you just had a conference up in the Bakken, so you're actively trying to get people to pay attention to the current legislation on the books as well as introduce other things. Talk to us a little bit about that process and some of the frustrations involved, because like you said, she was crying out for help for weeks and weeks and weeks to her law enforcement, family, church members, you name it. And it just, it
Right.
ended. Yeah. It's just very unfortunate. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what you're saying. It's a missed opportunity by so many people that came into contact with her. So part of me's like, is there just no training? Like I know something we spend a lot of time in North Dakota is we train law enforcement and medical because those are the two groups of people that survivors are most likely to come into contact with, like around 80% of the time. And so to us, it's really important that those people, all people receive education, but that you target the fields that are most likely to come into contact with a victim. And part of me is like, is it a lack of education? Is it were people scared or they just like blew it off? You know, because she's deemed as this crazy person, right? So all of those things are problems right there. And that is something that was even brought up at the Bakken is we have to take what people tell us seriously, especially with AI coming up too. Because the problem right now we're seeing is you could take anybody's photo on this call, right, and put it on a sexually explicit photo. And all of a sudden you're getting calls that, hey, your photo's out here, but you're like, no, it's not me. I need to be able to go to to law enforcement and I need them to believe me, right? And this isn't even me saying this. This is our law enforcement partners that we're working with that are saying this, we have to trust the victim's word. And so I think that is something in the nation, especially with new technology and what's coming forward, that we have to start trusting victims. We got to start trusting people for their word and at least look into it a little bit more in depth before saying, no, there's nothing there. So I think that's the biggest thing with these laws coming forward too, is we just have to really trust our victims that are coming forward versus shaming them instead, because I think that's what's happening is what we're seeing. Even with you know, we're trying to get laws surrounding sextortion right now as well. But the problem even in that case is a lot of the time the sextorters are from other countries. And we can have a state law here, but if they're in a different country, how do we mandate that too? But I think it still sends a message when we create state laws of what we will not tolerate within our communities. So we need to have legislation on these different topics, but we also have to trust our victims and we have to enforce the law. So all those things have to happen for this to work. And it clearly is was not in this scenario.
Can I ask you another question as long as we're talking about enforcing the law? Because this is some other things that people have experienced. My husband and I experienced this ourselves too, is you'll have a police officer that will enforce the law. They will arrest somebody, right? They'll give them a charge. However, now this person gets in front of a judge, and I know this is like an issue with domestic violence cases, is these people get in front of the judge. Number one, the judge will give them either a signature bond or a very, very low bond so they can bond out and not be in jail. And then they're roaming free. Then when it does come to sentencing, as long, the DA will work with them. The DA will be like, okay, you know what? As long as you plead guilty, we will reduce these charges. So maybe instead of a sexual assault charge, you get a misdemeanor, So how do we start combating this? So when the police do their job, they do charge these people with with the charges, and now we get to court, but now we've got these judges and the DA who are letting these people plead down. Like, What do we do as a society to start making changes to get these charges to stick?
Yes, that is a notorious problem that happens, especially with domestic violence a lot, where people are afraid again to report because nothing happens to the perpetrator. And I would say advocacy, it really comes down to that. People have to use their voices, but also when something besides law enforcement and medical, court personnel, they need to be trained as well. I'll just give another example. This was a different case where it was a trafficking situation happening, and there was a much older individual and this younger individual is who he was trafficking. And during the court, the judge at the time, he was an elderly individual, and he looked across the courtroom and he said, well, maybe he just likes to date younger women. That was his response. That's not what was going on there. It was clear this is a trafficking case, but instead he sided with the individual and said, maybe he just likes to, you know, have young women with him. Maybe that makes him feel better. Missed the whole premise of what was going on. So again, like, yes, you can train law enforcement and medical, but I would say our judges, our court personnel, they're not all well-versed, especially when it comes to like sex trafficking. A lot of people see it as they chose that, they wanted that, versus seeing them as a victim. And we really have to change that narrative. So I would say that advocacy piece, we have to be willing to have those tough conversations, even when it makes people feel comfortable. Whether you're in a big city or a rural community, you have to be willing to have those tough conversations to make change.
Absolutely. So I have a couple questions about the trafficking topic. Can you give us just a blanket statement definition of trafficking? And then I want to touch on a few things.
Yep. So the basic definition is selling a person for a good or service. Now, when we are trying to make a case with human trafficking, we have to prove three elements if they're over the age of 18. Force, fraud, and or coercion. If you're under the age of 18, we don't. But because it's so difficult to prove those elements, a lot of times the new strategy is when law enforcement go into a crime scene, seeing what other crimes are chargeable, just because it's so challenging to get the trafficking charge, as well as asking victims to testify in court. So if we can find other charges that will stick and they'll still get a good amount of time, at a corrections facility, we're going to go that route instead so we can protect that victim.
I just have a quick question for you. So when you say paid, it doesn't necessarily have to be money that they're paid, correct? It could be goods.
Yep.
And the reason why I ask this is because JP would, and I don't know if we would call this trafficking, maybe, he would pick up people on the street. And not only himself perform sexual acts on these people, but also make Micah and the people he picked up on the street perform sexual acts with each other. And he would, you know, like kind of tell her, like, if she didn't do this, you know, it was either going to be blackmail for her, or, I mean, I don't know, sort it out. I mean, I don't know if there was other things, like he would promise her if she would do this, but I mean, this is the kind of stuff that she was forced. I mean, would that be considered trafficking also?
Yeah, that could either be sexual exploitation or sex trafficking. The big difference is exploitation, it's often two people. So you would have like in this case, JP, who knows this person's vulnerable, right? Like they're looking for love, attention, or maybe a place to crash at their house, whatever. And so you say, hey, I can provide that for you. Time goes by. Well, you know, that's not for free. So you need to do this for me. So that's when we call it the sexual exploitation piece. Where it becomes trafficking is where that third person enters. And so, you know, let's say, like, just for the sake of this, right, that JP was grooming Micah to sexually engage with other people so that he could make some type of profit from that. That's when that would be deemed that trafficking piece because he's selling her to another person to make a profit. And then there's different types of traffickers out there. We call the Romeo pimp who's showering the person with love, affection, attention, the family member. Sack pimping is targeting people for drugs specifically. So you might know that they're addicted to heroin. So I'm gonna, you know, I'll help you out. I'll get you your supply, but this is what you have to do for me. So we have different categories of how we view traffickers when we are dealing with these cases as well. But yeah, I would see it as either a sexual exploitation, possible human trafficking. I think it could fit either, to be honest. And depending your state, and if it was across state lines, then you follow the federal law too. And so then that, you know, that gives you more room to deal with these scenarios too.
What I wanted to go into, she touched on a few of the things I wanted to talk about where he forced her with people off the street. And then if she wouldn't perform, he would force her to watch. I mean, just to get into her innocence a little bit, her dad gave an interview where he stated that JP had slept with an African American male off the street. And Micah did not want to participate, so JP forced her to watch. Then after the fact, JP and Micah were together, and then Micah told everybody what happened. She was not secret about it. She let not everybody, but you know, her close friends and family, they knew that he was forcing her to do these things, and she was confiding in them. And she told these people, you know, he slept with this African American male. And then I slept with him. So I think that now maybe I could be pregnant with an African child, African American child. And that just goes to show her innocence, her naiveness, and the how much
Right.
he had control and groomed her that she had not lived a life and learned things and that.
Yeah, for sure. Like where her mind was, her mindset, right? Yeah. I mean, you can definitely see that she didn't know. Cause that's the other thing is people will say, you know, why didn't they just walk away? Why don't you leave? It's just not that simple. And when you add blackmailing on top of it as well, the shame, the stigma, all of those things, and then the naiveness, right? All of that plays a role in this situation.
Absolutely.
How often does like you hear people say, you know, we built this life together, so like it's not easy to walk away from it. And if just this one thing would change, and in that example, you know, if he just wouldn't pick up male prostitutes, boy, we could move on with our life. They miss the bigger picture of the behavior and what leads you to do that. And can you talk about
Right.
that a little bit? Because it's like you can't see the forest for the tree type of a thing, you know? And I get it. I've been
Right.
there. So, I mean, I've been in
Yeah.
relationships.
It's pretty odd here.
Right.
I think
Yeah.
that.
If you're not addressing the underlying issue, it's not going to get better. Right. So, I mean, you can think if I do this or if we, you know, change this element, it'll get better, but you're not addressing the root of the problem. But when you're in that scenario, you just hold on to that belief that it'll get better. Like, if this would change, I know I can do this. Or they groom you to the point that you're so isolated that who else do you go to? And so maybe you do try to leave and then there's nobody, right? Or you don't get good services and then you come crawling back and that's what they hope for. And so you have that happens too. So a lot of the survivors we work with, they say it's not the physical abuse that they went through that's the problem. It's the psychological piece. And you can spend the rest of your life dealing with the psychological piece when you're in these situations because of that trauma bonding, that Stockholm syndrome. You're literally rewiring a person's brain. And so to rewire that back, that when I say a lifetime, I mean, we have survivors in our program that have been out of the life almost 20 years. And every day can still be a battle. There's good days and there's bad days, but they'll tell you it's the psychological piece for me that is still ingrained that I'm doing something wrong or that I need this person. So that doesn't quite answer what you're saying, but in a roundabout way, it's like if you don't fix the underlying issues. If you don't get the help you need or even realize you have a problem, it's not going to change. nothing's going to change. You have to be willing to fix the underlying issue. And a lot of people just don't want to face that.
Sorted out. Did you have another question along these lines?
Somewhat. I saw on your website, will you tell me how to say it correctly? Is it 318-31-8? How does it pronounce it correctly?
Just 318 project.
318 project. Okay. Mm-hmm. So on the 318 project website, you had a section about sexting. Can you go over that and how that correlates with domestic violence and sex trafficking? Because there's a lot of with JP Miller.
Yes. So when sexting, sextortion, that is some of our biggest issues we're dealing with right now, especially when it comes to youth specifically. And so, you know, sexting is really conversing with someone, sending sexually explicit images, phrases, things like that. And often what happens is once people send that, they will use that as blackmail. So just two different quick scenarios. We had one case where this young girl and boy in high school, madly in love, they were going to be together forever, which you hope would happen, but a lot of times it doesn't. They sent each other a lot of sexually explicit content. And when they graduated, they ended up breaking up. And when she got engaged in her early 20s, he was upset and took that content and sent it to a website in Russia. And that website in Russia started to profit off it. And even though she was a minor in some of the photos and some of them, she was 18, they wouldn't take it down, right? Because they're making money. And from a jurisdictional standpoint, it's very difficult for our law enforcement to get that down. Like they can try, but it's that jurisdictional issue. So you have that's happening. What we're seeing with the sextortion piece, unfortunately, we've had a lot of suicidal ideation or successful suicides because of sextortion. And a lot of them are more tailored towards males. So males, especially between that 14 to 16 year range, are definitely more of a target for what we call financial sextortion. And what's happening is people meet someone online and it looks like a young, attractive male or female. That's their type. And then this person convinces them again to send that sexual explicit photo. It gets sent. The next statement is, if you don't pay me $1,000, this is going out to all your friends and family. And unfortunately, we have had a case where within 3 hours of that scenario happening, that person took their life. And so that's why, like, when we talk about laws too, like the sextortion piece is really big, the sexting, we have to have better laws surrounding that because it's just so common. And our young people are, and it's not just young individuals, but they are a target when it comes to this.
And he did that. He had a picture, a topless picture of her that he posted online. It was there for an hour, but it doesn't matter. It was there and nothing was done about it.
Well, they said, out of curiosity, in this case, do we know if she had profiles out there that were under her name, but had sexually explicit content that he possibly created? Because that's another common tactic that traffickers will use, or perpetrators in general, when they have the sexually explicit content as a way of, hey, if you don't keep, like, you're not behaving, you're not doing what I'm asking you to do, all of a sudden a profile of them appears like they created it, but really it's the exploiter that created it. So I'm just curious if any profiles under her name came up with that type of material.
He did have access to all of her social media. He locked her out of all of her social media, her email, her original phone, and was posting and texting and messaging and emailing, pretending to be her. She had to get a new phone, create new socials because he was pretending to be her. Now I'm unsure her socials locked down. So I'm unsure if he ever posted stuff like that, but not that we know of at this point.
We do know that picture though that he did post of her topless did go on some kind of sexual explicit site, like Big Curves or something it was called. I can't remember. She did also, I believe, call the police on that also, but they said there was nothing they could do. I guess number one was because she sent the picture to him, and because she sent the picture to him, they said something to her like he could do whatever she want with it. And the second thing was he had some of her breasts blurred out. So there was nothing they were going to do about it.
So yeah, it does not surprise me. It's
That brings
especially if she
up
was over the age of 18 too.
that's just awful.
but my next point is really what we're talking about here, which is there are domestic violence aggressors who really know how to use the system very well to protect them and actually use it more of an abusatory way towards the victim that they're either physically abusing. Now they're emotionally and using the system to abuse them too. What worries me is that that is still happening, and there are a lot of certain personalities that do understand how to manipulate the system. But now that we're getting into a world of artificial intelligence, and we're getting into a world of Russian bots, and we're getting into a world of social media, to where the sex trafficking people are going to learn how to use the system in the same way the domestic violencers have used the system. Do you talking about with that? Because that scares me to where now you can have somebody who's in sex trafficking just grab, a parent's voice, manipulate it for artificial intelligence, say, "Hey, Johnny, I'll pick you up from school. I'm driving the white van today," whatever, type of a thing, and change them. Whereas in JP's case, it was used possibly for a 911 call and other times before. Now there's allegations that to set the narrative, an AI was being used when he hacked her account and some other things. But talk to me about that using the system a little bit, because that scares me.
Yeah, our laws have definitely not caught up to that. And that's the scary thing is AI, that it has so many great features, but it also has a lot of negativity to it too. And that's the piece that we are not fully capable of trying to navigate that yet. And that's like right now I can tell you all the conferences I've been going to and the conversations are surrounding AI, sextortion, sexual exploitation. That's the conversations that are happening because we're trying to figure out what do we do with this. That's the tricky part. What I'm also curious in this case too is have there been any search warrants or like have his technology been confiscated? Because a lot of times too, when we're talking about creating accounts and storing these images, they're going to be on devices or little flash drives, things like that. Has any like that would be the piece right now they need to get their hands on before that's destroyed. That would be my concern with this. Because if you got access to some of that, you could find out was AI used, was it generated to change the voice to create this message? But you need to have a warrant to get that material to make that happen. So that really concerns me on that. But I mean, again, like our laws have just not caught up of how do you deal with that? How do you prove it?
So
Yeah.
as far as we know, I mean, first of all, the unaliving of her passing was ruled a self-inflicted suicide. Okay, so that case had been closed, and nobody was going to even investigate that at all. It was closed, done, finished. And then recently, we found out that the FBI is investigating that, along with possibly like some kind of like money fraud that might have been going on within the church. So no, nobody has ever gotten a warrant or collected anything from him at all.
Yeah, that's concerning for sure, especially because a lot of this content is going to be, it's digital. Like you need devices in order to really look through it.
Not that we
And
have.
I mean, yeah, we literally, and there's a few states within the nation that have dogs that are literally trained to go into buildings, houses to sniff that material because there's a certain chemical that's on flash drives that stores what we call child sexual abuse material. And that's often like people will hide them, in so many random places. I don't want to give people ideas, but like that's why we have literally dogs that go into these houses and do that, and they do an amazing job. So in my mind right now, I'm like, we need to send a dog to go into these houses to see what's going on in the church, because my guess is there's definitely some devices stored somewhere.
So speaking of
Just
that,
making an assumption.
remember how we were talking about the police reports and that before, and I just remembered this. In one of the police reports, she did tell the police officer that she had been groomed, you know, she was being groomed by him. In the report, she said 10 years old, but we found out that she probably meant 2010 and it was misput in the police report. Why, if she said to this police officer, "I've been being groomed by this man since 2010," why wasn't that taken seriously?
Again, I'd be curious if that law enforcement is even well versed when it comes to trafficking or exploitation. And the other part too, and this is, I will say, this is really sad. A lot of youth don't have a voice. I mean, in some states right now, at the age of 14 or 15 years old, you can be arrested for prostitution. Think about that. What 14, 15, 16-year-old is choosing prostitution, right? Like, there's usually other factors. And if anything, we need to get them support, right? So our laws, again, in some states are still archaic, but youth, we say this a lot. We have to have strong advocates for youth because people don't take them serious. And we need to take their voice serious, but a lot of people don't. So I don't want to say I'm not surprised, but I'm not surprised that that situation happened because, again, I'd be curious, like, are they trained? And a lot of times, I don't know the size of this community, but in smaller communities, the law enforcement are trained to do everything, right? Where in bigger cities, you have detectives that are specifically trained to deal with drugs, to deal with human trafficking, to deal with youth. I mean, there's special curriculums of just how you work with youth, but in rural communities, you're tasked with doing it all. And so that's another gap we're seeing with this too, is juvenile law is different than how we treat adults. But if you have not had the proper training, you're not going to realize how to do that adequately. And it's not a pass, but it's what we're the issues we're definitely seeing.
Another subject with youths, while he was going through his divorce with his ex-wife, he had admitted to her that he was having inappropriate sexual relationships with minors in the church. And she put that in the affidavit and she knows who these youths are at the time. She went to them and told them, "Please go forward. Please go to the police and turn him in. This is not okay." And then they didn't want to, they were afraid of him. So she went to the police and told the police, "I know who they are. I want to make a report. I want to turn him in. You know, he needs to be held accountable for the things that he done." And the officers looked her in the eye and said, "No one's going to believe you because you are divorcing him." And they
Yeah,
did.
again, that's just a misuse of justice right there too, because obviously, if she reported that, especially like any mandated reporter, or just if I, well, had a deceased. Okay. Whether you are a man, thank you, a mandated reporter, or you just file a report, they have to look in that. And so do Child Protective Services. Like, that report should have gone to Child Protective Services to at least investigate it or do a welfare check or something. So it just blows my mind that that's the response that was happening. Is this a small community or is it large? What's
Not a
the
huge.
size that we're talking?
I'm gonna Google it here while we're on. I don't know the exact size. Let's see.
So
Yeah, I'm just trying to like grasp.
I just want to make it clear. I think that the victims that Sorted Out is talking about, this happened to them when they were a youth, but I believe they're adults now.
They are. But it's also been ongoing and still happening to minors from our understanding.
Yeah.
One of
And I'd be
the
curious of the statute there. Yeah.
So 40,865 is the population.
So it's a good size community. I mean, like, people should be trained. Is that's why I think I'm just a little shocked, you know.
Who would be considered a mandated reporter? Like, let's just even look at the church. Okay, so we've got this church. We know that she had gone to people in the church about things that were going on. This man has made sermons degrading his wife. Okay, everybody sat and listened to this. Who in this church would be considered mandated reporters?
Law enforcement, medical, counselors, social workers, teachers, all mandated reporters.
What about inside of a
And then
church, though? Like who in a
Inside of
church?
a church, right. And that's where it gets a little tricky. And a lot of times, churches will stand behind their own code. And it depends on the state. So some states have tried to pass bills that makes it that church officials would have to come forward, like let's say in a confessional, right? That somebody confesses a crime or confesses to being abused or something like that, that they should have to report that. And what I can tell you is usually lobbyists come in pretty hard against that when that happens. So I don't know what the law is in that area, but I can tell you like churches usually fight that one pretty hard and usually get by with not having to report.
So
Well,
is
so
are
would the elders and people on the board be considered mandated reporters or no?
depends on
No,
their
but
structure.
if outside of that, if their job pertains, like their outside job of that pertains, then yes. I mean, I even have some relatives sometimes that like before they tell me something, I will say, just so you know, depending the situation here, I have to report it. So, I mean, that's something I do just so people know. Like, I try to be transparent right from the front is like, I will hear you, I will listen, but if there is something going on here, I have an obligation to protect you. And this is what I'm going to have to do. So, I mean, that's just something I do. So I would hope other people in professions that are mandated reporters would take that serious.
Would a
Because you can get
private
in
school?
trouble. You can even lose your license in certain fields if you don't.
Would a private school, teachers of a private school have to be mandated reporters? Do you know that?
So that's interesting too. That I don't know.
Because they have a private
I've
school connected to the church. So some of
Right.
teachers at the private school are staff at the church and elders at the church.
My guess is it depends on the curriculum. If they're a charter school, if
That's what
they're
I'm thinking too. Yes, that would be my guess too.
there's a lot. This church is really seems like it's set up to be as
Right.
corrupt as possible. Like every sort of public trust the church has been given, they have stretched it to the umpteenth degree to where I wouldn't doubt if he gets money from the county for having jail people work there picking up trash on the weekends or something like that, because any way to get revenue, a lot of these different churches can do that. And one thing I do want to ask you though is about some of the structure that's set up there, because JP really does seem to surround himself with people that he can control, like in a very unusual way. Like, okay, you're an employee of the church. Go ahead, put your mortgage on there. We'll take care of that for you. Now you got the person's livelihood there. You know what I mean? Their actual shelter. One of the board members or one of the elders was a registered sex offender. So right there, do you really think that person's going to have any voice in the church? To go up, I mean, at any disagreement, he's going to say, "Listen, man,
Well, right.
do a favor."
And I'm guessing were youth, if youth were going to that church has to have a policy of
That's
how close that person can even get to. And I mean, again, like working with a lot of churches, like there a lot of churches have volunteer security, right? And usually they're in charge of like first they need to know, like, okay, that person needs to be forward. Are you a registered sex offender? And then usually it's up to the church, the policy they create. So I've seen anything from like, all right, you can only go to the restroom with another adult with you. Like things like that. You're not allowed to go into this part of the church because that's where a youth group is meeting. So do they have that? If it's a true C3, a true nonprofit, why hasn't it been reported? Also, right? Like if a church is doing corrupt things, they should be reported as well to the state. And so, has that happened, right? Or even with the federal government, their status should be revoked. And I don't know if any of that has happened, but Those are definitely things, you know, people should be reporting. And you can do that
I
anonymously through your Secretary of State's website and the federal government. Like you can do that anonymously too, is just report a tip. Because how is this church still show like running? Also looking at their finances, because from what you guys are saying, it sounds like he's using the church for financial things too.
There's a
So
lot to claim that. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people think that it's going to be a Al Capone deal where he'll probably go down for some sort of tax fraud, tax invasion, money type
right.
of green deal. I do want to circle back to parts of the case, which is so JP and his father. There's a parent and child sexual abuse allegations involved there. When I was doing interviews in some of the energy communities like Midland, Texas, like I mentioned, Bonford City, Oklahoma City, that type of thing, the part that jumped out to me was the parents that were selling their children into sex trafficking, and that blew me away. Like I was first aghast by 8 years old, 10 years old, being targeted. But then when I found out some parents were doing it for $1,000, something like that, just, I mean, like basically to pay rent for the month or whatever it might be. It's talk to me a little bit about that because that is a huge part of this. So when we talk about a sex offender, a registered sex offender at a church, for example, we're not pointing fingers and saying, how dare you? We're saying there's real issues here. That's one of those fail safes that's supposed to be a fail safe. What's happening here? Is it law enforcement? Is it the elders at the church? There's all these reporters that are in the audience of the church enabling this. I'm sure you're a teacher at some school during the day. I'm sure you're this. That's what we're talking about, people. All the fail safes that fail, all of them that fail. Because at the end of the day, there are parents selling their children for a small amount of money. I'm going to get down off my soapbox now. Stacey, I'm going to hand it over to you. You can me
No,
down.
but you're saying exactly. That's like you are totally right. Anytime we've seen a lot of that generational trafficking, where maybe you grew up in a system where you poverty, you didn't have much. And so in order to get heat for the house, your parent had you sleep with that individual or to get those groceries. And all of a sudden you have children. And the same thing happens, right? Because it's been normalized. And that's what you grew up doing. So we have lots of scenarios like that that happen. And I think it's just disappointing. And this isn't the first case I've seen like this, where so many people had an opportunity to step in and didn't. So what do we do to improve this so it doesn't keep happening again and again? And that's, I mean, I don't have an answer to that, right? But I think it's just so unfortunate. I mean, all the people listed here, the community, the church, law enforcement that have that opportunity to step in. And then also realizing for these people in these scenarios, this is normal to them. This is what they grew up in. This is how their parents were raised, then they had kids, and it continues on. So having those conversations of why it's not normal, like that's not normal. You talk about different ways that people can traffic, recruit. We often don't talk about that factor with religion, right? Culturally, how you can control somebody. Religion's the same way. Like you can control people, not the right ways, right? That, and I think that's also what we're seeing in this scenario too. Like I'm not going to name some of the other types of religions out there where we've seen similar behavior, like cult-like behavior that has happened, but we've also found trafficking rings within those sectors. So it just sounds like there's a possibility of that happening here too. And I'm not going to say that for sure. I'm just saying, looking at the pattern of history, that definitely shows some of those signs.
I was going to
So
ask.
from a lot of the investigating and looking around that we have done, and I know Sorted Out will back me up on this one. And please keep in mind, like what we're saying right now is alleged. We're not saying this is for sure, but there have been rumors that this church is connected to other churches, and there possibly is trafficking within these churches. A lot of people that are connected to this church are involved in some way, have their own businesses, and everything's, and it's numerous businesses. It's not just one, it's numerous, and everything's under a nonprofit and called like a ministry, if you will.
Yep. I mean, that's red flags written all over it. I mean, there's, again, at the top of my head, there's other religions that are coming, or churches coming to mind without saying them, where this same thing, we have seen that happen, right? And I mean, there's red flags there, right? So it's like, what are we going to do with that? Like, there's something there. You said the FBI has gotten involved in this case too at this point?
Yeah. For a couple of reasons they did. For the money part initially, there are reports that Micah had informed the FBI of some of the issues involved with the finances, including mission trips to Africa. And also, you know, with some different properties and et cetera. That's why when I first got my attention to this, I thought, okay, he's going to go down, but it's going to be for Al Capone type of things involved with taxes and money and laundering. You know, I grew up Catholic. So, I mean, I'm very attuned to, you know, the whole Catholic of that sex offenders. And I was an altar boy, so I was even a little bit more attuned to those types of things. And so at the same time, I know a few people who have started churches and have started churches through a variety of different ways. And my understanding is that this church is not even affiliated with like a branch of Christianity. When you talk about the snake handlers, you know, like the snake handlers are even a branch of Christianity. Like, this is just a way to write off tax in my mind. And so Black Sheep, when you're asking, you know, kind of your question about these different things, I almost felt like jumping in and saying, no, this is more of a business model than it is anything else. This is just kind of a way to dump all the money into a pot and then use it for whatever you want. That to me is like the ultimate business that you can create. And actually, a tax-exempt church allows you to do that because you can write benevolence in the subject matter and give it to an investigative reporter to go get sleazy information on somebody trying to do their job, and et cetera, et cetera. But I know we're getting kind of late on the time, so I just kind of wanted to have everybody go around a little bit and kind of give some final thoughts and sort it out. I think you have a question first, or you look like you're ready to jump in, so get ready.
There's so much going on in my mind. I guess my final question would be, I guess I might have a few here. Let me see. I've got a list here, so let me find a couple of that. Okay, what? I had a question from one of my viewers earlier. Okay. Safe places for DV victims to go if they do not have family or money or shelter in the area. How can they be sure to, and they're ready to leave? Number one. Number two, how can we get these training and seminars in our local areas to bring more awareness to DV and ST? And then number three, what can we do at our local level to help DV and ST victims?
Yeah, for sure. So first, see what your area has for shelters. Like, I think that's a big thing. How close are you? Is there a hotline in your community that you could call? So for instance, in North Dakota, we do have each larger city, and granted, like our larger cities are still pretty small in North Dakota, but they all have DV shelters and a crisis line associated with it. And so, even in a state like ours, I think we have 10 or 11 different shelters, and they also do go into rural communities as well. And like I said, they have hotlines that are manned 24/7. So definitely look in your area, see what shelters are out there and what, you know, numbers are associated with those shelters. That would be my biggest thing, especially if you're not sure. You know, some people do have trust issues with law enforcement. So if that's obviously, if it's an emergency, we want you to call 911. If you're worried you have some trust issues, definitely look up those crisis hotlines in your area. Make sure you have access to those. And a lot of those pages, once, like, let's say you pull it up on a computer and you are worried that that person who might be your abuser will see it, there's always a button. We have it on our website too, that you click and it gets you out of it. So you don't have to worry about them accessing that within your history. Most DV websites have that button. So just know that that's a way to protect you as well.
Like an easy download.
In terms of education, feel free to reach out. You can always reach out to me directly or check our website. We are connected with a lot of people throughout the United States. So depending where you're at, I could at least direct you where you could get information, or more training on these topics. Obviously, like, we give training virtual a lot too. So, you know, if you would like 318 Project to provide any training, we're happy to do that. But we're also happy to connect you with some of your local resources too. So either way, we can at least just be a resource for you.
Okay, I will absolutely be reaching out to you. I'd love to do that. Thank you.
I have a question, actually. Is my mic on? Yeah, it is. Okay. We were talking a little bit about Myrtle Beach earlier, and that's a touristy community. And so that would be one of the higher, I guess, identifiers when it comes to a sex trafficking area. I mentioned the energy communities that I had covered in the past, Midland, Odessa, Oklahoma City, Watford City. These saw spikes around the same time that, you know, some of these energy communities, energy companies came to town. Are there any other kind of industry identifiers, if you will, that somebody may be living in a community probably should be aware of? Because tourist and high energy kind of transit-y communities tend to have the higher sex trafficking and violence numbers.
Yeah. So would hunting, fishing, you know, if you're a community that has a lot of that's going on, like people, a lot of tourism comes to your area for like fishing, hunting, those are big ones. Sporting events, anything that draws in a larger crowd, you're definitely going to see an increase of criminal activity, more so with that sex trafficking piece. But any, you know, rural communities sometimes have a lot of people coming, again, for that hunting, that fishing, those other extracurricular activities, you will definitely tend to see a rise in sex trafficking happening during those times.
Is that because of the vehicles, because of the personalities? Because I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, like when you mentioned hunting before, that never crossed my mind, but you
Yeah.
could have a lot of different trucks and tents and all kinds of, you know, trailers and things like that. So.
Yeah, it's kind of twofold. And I'm not picking on the sector. So please know, like, all sectors have problems. Like, I'm not saying that, but what we find a lot, especially with hunting, a lot of adult males that have a male children use it as a coming of age opportunity. So, like, let's say you're on a hunting trip and you're that parent and you're like, you know what? I'm going to go purchase a prostitute because I want my son to come of age, like experience, you know, a sexual relationship for the first time. So we see some of those scenarios that happen, like that coming of age. So there's that element, but then there's also might just be a group of adults. They're from a different state. They come to this rural community. They will seek that out. Yeah, we've definitely seen those scenarios. So those are like the two common things I see is more I'm far away from home. This is my opportunity to seek this out. Or again, I want to use this opportunity for my son. to experience his first sexual encounter. It's very strange. Yes, we have a lot of strange things that happen for sure.
My son turned 18 this year. He graduated. And honestly, that coming of age thought never entered my mind one time to go to Vegas and get him an escort for the night. That never entered my mind one time. Go ahead.
Real quick on the topic of the sex workers, are there programs, sex workers, to rehabilitate them and, help them? Because I know that there are people out there that feel like that's, they're not worth anything more and that's their only option.
Absolutely. We specifically do have a program, a survivor mentorship program, and we have a support group that meets every other week. And people are able to access that through Zoom as well. And so that we do have that. And then they're paired with a mentor who helps them to achieve different goals, anything from getting their GED to we just had a survivor who her goal was to get her GED and she wants to become a social worker. And she just got accepted into a social work program. We've had survivors start catering business, or because for some of them, their trauma is so complex that just to do small errands on their own can be challenging. But we're not the only ones, of course. Like Rebecca Bender Initiative, she also has a curriculum that people can access. And I know there's other ones too that I'd be happy. I'm kind of blanking on some of them, but I know there are a few other programs out there that, again, we'd be happy to link people to.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Black Sheep, you got any final thoughts? Any questions here?
I just, yeah, I'm just a few. So, the first question I have for you is, and I know I talked about this in the beginning about child on parent domestic violence. Do you agree with me when I say that there are signs at younger ages of children that if things aren't dealt with at the time when they're showing some of these signs, that they can grow up to be domestic violent abusers?
I think there's definitely behavior that happens that you have to be aware of for sure. I would say for not just even domestic abuse, I would say for other types of criminal activity too, that people should be, more diligent watching that sometimes. I know sometimes people will use the phrase like kids will be kids. There's a certain line there though, right? Where if you cross that line, okay, we need to look into this a little bit more. So yeah, I think parents should watch those things. And if you're noticing different types of behavior, consult with somebody about that, that has expertise with working with children that have different behavioral issues, so you can start working with them at a younger age, if possible.
What things should parents like look for?
I would say, like, let's say, a child has a very aggressive personality. What's causing that? If you notice, harming other animals, right? Like that can be a sign that there's something going on. Abusing another sibling. When it comes to like sexual abuse too, it's not uncommon for siblings to sexually abuse each other. Like we've seen a lot more of those types of cases come forward. So maybe noticing that type of behavior. They shut their door a lot. I would even say from a social media aspect, I would encourage parents to not allow children to bring their technology in their rooms with them. A lot of our cases have happened when that child has a device on their own and they connect with someone online. And that person convinces them to send sexually explicit content. We had a case where the perpetrator, this went on for 4 years, was even watching her sleep through a webcam at night. And the parents had no idea that was going on, but her behavior started to shift. But they just really didn't see it until like 4 years later. So behavioral issues, like if you go from being that happy, positive person to anxious, depressed, angry, right there off the bat, like something's going on. So you need to dig deeper and get appropriate help for that, or just some things that come to mind.
So I know we had talked about like JP, and we speculate that his issues stem from him being sexually abused as a child. What about parents who you have parents who are, parents are together and let's say happy family, if you will, but you still end up with this child who is aggressive, maybe abusive to the parents. I mean, and when I say abusive, not just, I mean, every kid sometimes hits their parents, whatever. You know what I'm saying? I'm talking about abusive to their parents and abusive to the siblings, has found, been found maybe, sexting, all this stuff at like a young age. I mean, I guess where I'm going with this is you don't necessarily have to have something wrong or to have these behaviors, correct?
Exactly. And I don't know what other states all offer, but I can tell you, like in our area, we actually do have programs for youth that are dealing with behavioral issues, where they actually, depending what the issue is, they can be in the program for almost a full year. It can be sometimes shorter, longer, depending what that behavioral issue is. And it didn't have to be, they don't have to be sentenced there. Right? It's not because they committed a crime to go there. It's just like they can be referred to there. So I would be curious again, depending where you live, definitely seek those things out because there should be some type of programs available, I would hope, in other communities that are similar that offer those opportunities to get kids on the right path. And it doesn't have to always be like a parent issue, right? There can just be other things going on in that for that kid. When you talk about the psychological piece, right? There could be something going on that has nothing to do with the parents, but in order to get them the proper treatment, they need to go through these different programs.
The only reason why I bring that up is because in the support groups that I've been in, the majority of parents, there is no help for these children. You can't even get them in, you can't even get them into a facility, where they stay, because the facility will tell you, yes, we treat mental health issues in children, but your child's too aggressive, and if they're violent, we don't accept them.
That is interesting. Like I said, I know there are programs that do, but I also know there's a lack of mental health services across the nation as well. So I recognize that. That is challenging though. And I'm not sure even, what I could see where people would feel defeated for sure when you don't have the proper support systems in place in a community. And I don't
So
even
many.
know, like I'd be curious in North Dakota if they take, kids from other states. I don't know.
And so
The
many of
other.
these individual and so personal that almost every single one has to be a case by case basis because
It
they're just,
is.
And
And it's based on assessments, and then the assessments have to provide certain numbers and things like that. And that is a tricky piece there too, because if they don't hit a certain number, like that can make or break if the facility will take the child as well.
I
Other
did want
thing,
to
the
add
other
to
thing.
of this investigation in parallel with trafficking and domestic violence is that is going back to this kind of this grooming, if you will, because you mentioned some children bringing their technology into their bedroom. Well, what got me really kind of focused on this is how will oftentimes a predator will pick somebody out when they're 14, 12, 10, 11, whatever the age is. And in the JP Micah case, it was 14. Okay. So that's what's so interesting to me is that all of these like horror stories that you hear through the invisible internet actually played out right before our eyes in church. So when we talk about the grooming, when we talk about the internet, basically somebody in Russia or somebody in New York or wherever the predator is living, they're waiting for that one night they get into a fight with their parents over the course of 6 years, over the course of 8 years. They don't have, like what JP had, the ability to send the husband over there so they could isolate here. This is happening just through Snapchat and TikTok and social media, where basically one time they meet them, and then over the course of 6 years, they're just waiting for that one night to say, you know what, I'll meet you at the ice cream place, I'll buy you some Rocky Road, and then boom, that's it. So to me, that's what's so interesting is that it played out in church with the pastor, and what you've been warning people, Stacy, is happening online. So talk to me a little bit about the age, the grooming, and how it's happening online, because we see in church this case.
Average age in which someone is targeted is between 12 and 14. So like us as an agency, we spend a lot of time going into schools and having these conversations with youth. We make sure it's age appropriate for them. But you have to have these conversations at a younger age because of that social media aspect. And unfortunately, sometimes it can take only a couple of days or weeks or months for these scenarios to escalate at its capacity. The other thing I would tell people, and this is what we tell kids, if I post online, like my life sucks, my parents don't get me, I have no friends. If I'm a predator, I want to be your friend, right? Because I want to tell you how you don't need those people. They don't get you anyway, but I do. I'll be your friend. That's what we call the rescuer, right? The rescuer trafficker. They're there to kind of feed you on that I'm going to help you. And so it's really important to have conversations with youth. The study came out a couple months ago that the average age of a child having a technology device like an iPad is 18 months. So if you have a device that has access to the internet within 18 months, you got to start having conversations of what they're going to see online, what they could encounter online. Another study came out that the average amount of time a parent spends talking to a child about internet safety in their lifetime is 43 minutes. So just think about that we will spend how much time talking to kids about all these different topics, but we spend less than an hour talking to youth about social media safety. But we don't even hesitate to give them an electronic device. So all of those things, we got to be aware. Something we're doing in our state is we actually, our Bureau of Criminal Investigations, they are hosting parenting classes to show parents how to use different apps so that they can be ahead of the child. Because what's happening right now is children often are more equipped to use technology than some of us adults are, because they're basically like they grow up in it, right? And so how do we catch parents up to speed so that they know what to actually look for and how to monitor a device properly? Like that's just one avenue we're trying. NetSmarts though is another great resource out there as well, just to give you tools of how you have these conversations with youth to try to protect them.
Would you agree that today and now in today's day and age that a lot of children are too young when it comes to social media? When I'm not saying necessarily the internet, because I know you have to have the internet to do homework and things like that. I'm talking about, do you feel that we are giving our youth access to Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, all these different social media platforms too early?
Yeah, for sure. And I'm not the only one that would say that either. I think if you work with a lot of people that have worked in this field or have dealt with internet crimes against children, they're going to tell you that's exactly what's happening, is predators are using Snapchat, TikTok, Facebook Messenger, Instagram, all of these different platforms. And I'm on some of these platforms. I get that they can be used as good tools, but they can also be used for a lot of malicious activity too. So yes, I do think we are giving kids access to these platforms at too young of an age. And it's not just about the predators. It's also about the mental health piece, what that's doing to kids as well.
The other question I have for you, and now it just left my mind. That's right.
That's all right. We
It
better
might
wrap
come
it
back.
up. 9:30. So, any final thoughts, Stacy, that we should walk away with from this? You know, I mean, basically, we wanted to use the case as kind of our bullet points to talk about the different trafficking and some of the domestic violence involved, because the real attraction of this, I believe that Micah Miller is a martyr when it's all said and done, because of how many people are connected to this through a variety of different ways, a variety of different ways. But at the end of the day, we're here to educate and create awareness. So direct people to your site or any other research. Sorry, I'm getting mosquitoes in the studio here.
Can I quick ask you one more question, please? And just for the people that are out there and listening to this, I know we went over trafficking. Can you explain, though, to everybody so everybody knows what is grooming?
So grooming is basically you're breaking someone down, and you can do this in different ways. You can shower them with that love, attention, affection, gifts, isolating them. Those are like the common tactics that we see when someone's trying to groom a person for a certain thing. So if you notice sudden changes in someone's behavior, they start dating somebody noticeably older, they start hanging out with a new friend group, and you notice that their personality drastically changes, those are red flags to us that something's going on. I'm not always saying that's human trafficking, right? But something's happening in that scenario that you need to be aware of. And again, as that friend, that family member, you're in a position to then try to provide them with help in some shape or form, right? And even if it's like just reaching out saying, hey, I really care about you, and they blow you off 50 times, don't stop. You want them to always know that you're there, because eventually they will find that courage and that strength to reach back out to you. But they want to know that you're still invested. And so even if they blow you off, to keep communicating with them. But yeah, that grooming, again, isolating, gifts, love, affection, attention, all of those things are different tactics that can be used. But I do want to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to join you guys tonight. I really appreciate just learning more about this case as well. And I guess what I would just really tell people out there is, if you suspect something is going on in someone's life, please be that advocate for them. You know, try to. If you can't get them to trust you or listen to you, still report it, or find different resources. You know, even contact us. Like, we will help you navigate these different things. But don't give up on people. Like, be that advocate, because you just never know who out there is waiting for someone to come along that they can trust and that will believe them in their situation. So I think that's my biggest thing, to just, you know, don't give up on other people. Be that voice to help other people.
Stacey Shaver, 318 Project, website, social media, all kinds of different stuff. And thank you so much for your time and Sorted Out and Black Sheep. Thank you so much too for your time and information and contributions to this. I'm going to post the fundraiser for Micah Miller's family as well after this is all said and done. So anybody out there wants to donate to their family, I'll have the information after this interview as well, because we're here to support their family as well. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much for having us. Nice to meet you, Stacey. Nice.
Yep. Thank
Stacey,
you,
we all need.
guys.